Geekscape.com.
Hello and welcome to Aryan Narrations. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks. And today's reading is part 9 from Et Volsink's Front Camphor. The day came when Et lost his relatively favourable position in the central food supply section of Voigt concentration camp. He was transferred by police van to the civilian prison at Zutphen, where he would begin the final stage of his imprisonment after the capitulation of 1945. He was still wearing the last ragged remains of his military uniform, together with a shabby bundle that passed for luggage or personal effects. The sight of his uniform, no matter its condition, provoked an extremely hostile reception on his arrival at Zutphen. The guards in the reception area immediately confiscated his remaining belongings and ordered him to strip naked. After his rags were confiscated, he was locked in an empty shower cubicle. Et surveyed his new surroundings. He considered himself to be a lucky man, having had a narrow escape from a death sentence and being taken away from the privations of the camp at Voigt. Now, he stood naked in a shower cubicle. Compared with what he had been through at Voigt, this was nothing to worry about. Although there was no room to sit down, he did not mind standing there alone for a few hours. Suddenly, a small window in the cubicle door opened, and looking up, Et met the gaze of a pair of blue eyes. A friendly voice said, "I am Fred. Who are you?" Et answered, giving his real name. The voice behind the eyes spoke again, "Are you political?" Et hesitated, not fully understanding the direction of the questions, but answered carefully that he had been convicted of serving in the German army. "Fine," answered the voice. "Me too. Which division were you in?" Thinking carefully about his answers, Et decided against mentioning his capitulation in the ranks of the 34th SS Division, as he had not actually served in that formation and knew practically no one in the 34th SS. Identifying himself as a part of the 34th SS could cause complications. Et replied that he had served in various units and would talk about it later, but assured his unknown questioner that he was Waffen-SS. To confirm the truth of his statement, Et raised his left arm to show the SS blood group tattoo. This demonstration seemed to satisfy the questioner, who said, "Fine, I will see that you are moved into my unit, but I must go now. They are coming back to fetch you." The eyes at the window disappeared, and silence reigned again. Then, a few minutes later, the door of the shower was opened by a pessimistic-looking warden who ordered Et out into the corridor, still naked, and to follow him to the prison's quartermaster's store, where an equally pessimistic official roughly measured Et and threw various items of clothing at him, underwear, socks, shoes, and a type of prison uniform. He put on the plain clothing and, once dressed, was looked over by the quartermaster, who informed him that any lost clothing would have to be paid for. Et puzzled as to how he would do that. The only clandestine money he had possessed, via his girlfriend in Voigt, had been confiscated, so now he had no money of any kind. The warden silently gestured for Et to march back down the corridor, and he realized that he would be facing a long stay at Zutphen, and probably in other prisons too, whatever else his future looked gloomy. Et marched along behind the warden and into the prison director's office. The new prisoners were interviewed by the prison director himself after first being processed before they were admitted to one of the three political sections. All prisoners were stripped of their possessions and their names, keeping only their naked bodies and their prison number. The prison director was a typical representative of the old conservative, traditionalist, Calvinist caste, a dying breed in left-wing post-war Holland. his attitudes and beliefs belonged to a long-forgotten past, the stuffy and starched conservatism of turn-of-the-century Netherlands. The director's principal question was always to which branch of the Christian faith the prisoner belonged, a category in which he included all of the 360 non-Catholic religious subgroups and cults. Ed was not a Christian at all, and he tried to explain this to the Churchill lookalike before him, but his explanation was either ignored or the director was just not listening. After a brief pause for reflection, the prison director decided that Ed Volsink was a Christian and a Protestant, thereby he must join and attend a regular church service within the prison. In this particular institution, the Protestants were governed by an alcoholic pastor who operated like a member of the mafia. After having his religious beliefs assigned by the director, Ed was sent off to resume his journey in the footsteps of the warden. He followed him on a long march down seemingly endless corridors until finally he halted at a door. The warden knocked, only to be turned away as it was the wrong room, and he then knocked at a second door, which was opened by a pleasant-looking elderly warden. The older man welcomed Ed into the section, which he informed him was part of the P-Wing. From now on, Ed had a new name. It was P-63, which stood for Political Prisoner Number 63. The elderly warden in charge of the sections that Ed had been assigned to was called Samuels. He handed Ed a folder of rules and regulations specific to the P-Wing, and Ed soon became aware that as far as Zutphen prison was concerned, a prisoner on the P-Wing was not allowed to do anything without permission from Samuels. Virtually the only thing a P-Wing prisoner was allowed to do without permission was breathe. Samuels left the room, and Ed found himself in the company of a dozen young men of roughly the same age as himself. One of them, approximately a head taller than Ed, stepped forward and with typical SS bearing presented himself as Fred. After this, the rest of the assembled company introduced themselves only with their first names and their P numbers. Once the introductions were over, the rest moved away, leaving Ed in Fred's company, who was obviously the one instructed to initiate Ed into the prison routines and the prisoner's secrets. The room he had been assigned to was quite large, with a series of bunk beds, a large table to eat communal meals from, or to sit and study at, and finally there were some small tables and chairs set in the room corners. Fred told Ed that Zutphen was not exactly a prison, but more of a hard labour institution for political prisoners, conscientious objectors, and less dangerous petty criminals. As Ed was soon to discover, the P-Wing at Zutphen prison was full of Dutchmen who were active National Socialists and had served at some level in the Wehrmacht or Waffen-SS. There were three sections on the P-Wing. The rest of the prison was reserved for young criminals, with a small wing set aside for post-war conscientious objectors to military service, something that Ed had personally never heard of before. These men were all members of an ultra-Christian religious sect from the northern tip of the Netherlands and were totally non-political. It struck Ed as strange that these religious objectors had been sentenced to 2 years imprisonment from a pro-left-wing government, never fond of militarism. In later years, the objectors would probably have received the soft option of public welfare or community service rather than prison. Most of the P prisoners were young SS officers, with long sentences ahead of them, but not all. In Ed's room, two of the occupants were not SS and were unwilling to discuss their past. Two others were Kriegsmarine and probably homosexuals as well. Ed was quickly briefed by Fred as to who he could trust and how he should conduct himself. Fred told Ed that he was an ex-officer of the 34th SS Division, Landsturm Nederland, the very formation which Ett had submerged himself in at the surrender in May 1945. Ett's decision not to mention his involvement with the 34th SS Division during his first few hours at Zutphen was justified. It was with a fair degree of caution that Ett told his new confidant that he had been a part of the Oranienburg SS formation. He was still unsure of his newfound comrade and avoided all mention of his time with the Brandenburg ZBV 800 and was especially careful to avoid mentioning any connection with the werewolf or the manner of his capitulation. Fred warned him to be careful about discussing his past in general conversation, even in their room of the P-Wing. The two men, who remained silent about their backgrounds, were probably ex-members of the SD, the Sicherheitsdienst, security police, and dare not discuss their careers in front of former serving soldiers. It was also suspected that at least one of these men had turned coat and was now acting as an informer for the prison authorities. Ed soon discovered that morale among the men in his company was high, and conversations about the future were far from pessimistic. The SS spirit remained strong among the bulk of these men, and Ed had no problems of any kind with his new comrades. Among the prisoners, Fred was supervisor of the rooms, effectively a kind of trustee, but his SS loyalty was firm and solid. He reflected on the subject of the Oranienburg SS, and instructed the others not to ask Ett any questions about the unit or to quiz him about confidential matters. Despite the shared experience of torture, ill-treatment and starvation in the detention camps, the prisoners were still able to talk enthusiastically about their military achievements and feat of arms. As with soldiers the world over, they also discussed families and daily events. The normality of this prison existence helped Ett to relax and take stock of his situation, and to test out who among the other prisoners he could trust. On the first Sunday of his stay in Zutphen, Ett was marched along to his compulsory Protestant church service. This was the first time in his life that Ett had attended a Protestant religious service, which he regarded as a ridiculous performance. This was also the opinion shared by some others in his P-Wing section. It was with the help of a Catholic section warden that Ett and his closest comrades were able to acquire an unusual private audience with the pastor, where they were able to challenge his views and argue for their exclusion from the church services. In spite of all his best efforts at these private sessions, the pastor was unable to shake the shared SS ideals about religion, and eventually capitulated, telling the SS men that they were lost souls, but with the help of Jesus Christ, he could endeavour to save them all from hell. Nothing changed. The routine of the P prisoners at Zutphen was to provide free labour for the local district, working on the restoration or rebuilding of war-damaged buildings, helping local farmers to gather in the harvest, and for the ex-soldiers among the P-Wing, clearing minefields and unexploded bombs. The general opinion among the prisoners was that the prison director was making enormous profits by selling the prisoners as cheap labour or slave labourers to local farmers and builders. Not only was the prison director suspected of getting rich out of this exploitation, but he was also gaining promotion for his success in assisting with local reconstruction. The first work detail which Ett was assigned to was harvesting carrots on those local farms where the highest bids had been made to the prison director for their labour. The prisoners received no wages for their work. As a general rule, criminals in the Netherlands did not work outside the prisons. If the work parties were lucky, they would receive some form of compensation from the farmers. Prisoners were far behind the rest of the Dutch population in terms of rations. The farmers would give them extras of dark bread, buttermilk, and sometimes strong tobacco when the working day ended. The P-Wing prisoners were taken out into the surrounding countryside in trucks, where the working parties pulled carrots by hand and loaded them for transportation to market. This was hard physical work in all weathers, and a type of labour which Ett had no previous experience of, unlike the religious prisoners from the P-Wing, who were all farming stock and born to this work. The ex-soldiers could not match their agricultural skills. However, if the former soldiers could not beat the conscientious objectors at farm work, they soon found another means of scoring points over their non-military compatriots. Although the prisoners were ferried out to the fields in trucks, the return journey at the end of each day was made on foot. The distance from the farms to the prison was easily 15 miles, and in no time at all, the old military skills of route marching returned to Ett and his comrades, a skill not easily acquired by the religious objectors. Not only did the old marching skills return to the former soldiers, but other old habits returned as well, in particular the singing of marching songs as they returned home. The old war songs of the Wehrmacht and the Waffen-SS sounded loud and clear along the roads and through the villages around Zutphen prison. Even the religious conscientious objectors discovered that, despite their loathing of marching, singing as they marched helped to alleviate their suffering. So it was with some amusement to Ett and his comrades that the religious P-prisoners tried to sing along with the ex-soldiers as they marched back each evening. Struggling with the words, the objectors could only join in with the melodies and choruses. However, it did not take long for word of the singing marching columns to reach the prison authorities. The surrounding villages soon sent messages to the prison director, telling him that the war was over, the German army had been defeated some years ago, and that they did not need reminding of the occupation by columns of murderers marching down their roads singing Nazi battle songs. So the Harvest Commando was stopped, and the working parties broken up into smaller groups of 8 or 10 men, supervised by a warden. In addition, all transport was now by small vans and prison buses, and work was restricted to digging ditches, demolition work, and building site work. The warden in charge of Ett's working detail was anxious to keep a friendly, easy atmosphere away from the prison, knowing as he did that he and his single pistol had little chance against the battle-hardened Waffen-SS veterans. After inspecting the first work quota of the day, the warden would usually say, "Boys, just get moving, and I will go and see if I can find some extras for you." The warden would return with a small quantity of extras to distribute amongst the tired working detail. The prison food was never enough to satisfy the demands of their bodies, generally, but after a day's labour, they were even hungrier. However, even more than food, the prisoners had a seemingly constant need for tobacco, and often this replaced extra food rations at the end of the day. Although the warden was very relaxed about guarding the working party, nobody ever tried to escape. It would have been very easy to escape, especially for a Brandenburger like Ett. But where would they go? Where could they go? Ett had not forgotten his werewolf orders, and some months later, he was assigned to a working party at a paper mill. During the few weeks he spent there, Ett made friends with one of the labourers, and he hoped to use this man in order to make contact with his werewolf comrades. At first, all seemed to go well. The mill labourer promised to help Ett contact his friend on the outside by leaving a note at a student house in the town of Leiden. The note was a coded message to the werewolf operative and should have been pinned on the general notice board of the student residence. However, the supposedly friendly mill worker decided to betray Ett to the prison authorities by revealing his attempt to contact friends on the outside, which was, of course, strictly forbidden. Ett was immediately taken before the prison director and received 3 days solitary confinement in the punishment block. He was also warned that any further breach of regulations would cost him a full third of any possible remission of sentence. In the face of such threats, Ett decided to keep his head down, but at the same time started to take out his frustrations on one of the 2 non-SS inmates of his room. Ed started to target the man who he had been keeping under observation since his arrival, an Aryan-looking fellow of his own age, but who had extremely bad eyes. Although this man wore spectacles, he was always blinking and could obviously never have been a frontline soldier. One day, Ed isolated this man in a quiet corner of the room. Fred had assured Ed that the rooms in the P-Wing were not bugged with hidden microphones. Ed was quick to question his fellow prisoner. "Comrade, you understand that I have had a rather dubious position here with my military past. Therefore, may I ask you what you did during the war to deserve such a harsh sentence?" Obviously intimidated by Ed's threatening manner, the man explained rather nervously that he was rejected for service in the Wehrmacht because of his eyesight. However, he had served in the Landwacht Nederland, which was a semi-police force under the command of Van Gielkerken, deputy leader of the NSB, which supported the Dutch country police in the Netherlands. As Ed had spent the greatest part of the war years outside the Netherlands, he was almost completely ignorant of the wartime situation there and had no means to verify the fellow's story. However, the bespectacled man impressed Ed with his honest replies and trustworthy manner, so that Ed had no more doubts about his character. He became more relaxed and talkative, telling Ed that his name was Hans, and assured Ed that he could trust him. However, he warned Ed that the other non-SS inmate of their room was not to be trusted, and unfortunately, this untrustworthy fellow occupied the bunk above Ed. The untrustworthy prisoner was a diabetic, and so he was excused from hard labour duties. Not only that, but he was also employed in the prison director's household. Both these pieces of information about the man in the bunk above him displeased Ed. The fact that the man was an informer was bad enough, but Ed was extremely superstitious about the diabetes. He could not move bunks, as he was still recovering from the effects of the hip wound that he had received during the missions in the Ardennes, prior to the winter offensive of Christmas 1944. Ordinarily, the hip injury would have long since settled down, but due to the rushed surgery at the time, and the privations and starvation diet he had suffered in the Haaskampf, the pain and inflammation repeatedly returned, making walking and climbing any obstacle difficult. It was because of this condition that on arrival at Zutphen, Ed had to sleep on the lower level bunks. He had no real medical knowledge and was afraid that somehow the body sugars and fluids of the man sleeping in the bunk above would leak down and spill onto Ed's face. As a desperate measure to counter the imagined threat, Ed took to sleeping with a towel over his face, a habit he has persisted with for the rest of his life. It was impossible for Ed to make contact with his NS connections in the world outside the prison, and so he could not possibly check out the details of the informer's life. However, one evening, after enduring a compulsory lecture from the prison's Protestant pastor, Ed made a virulent anti-Christian and anti-Jewish speech to the other prisoners in his room during the evening meal. The next day, Ed was dragged before the prison director and was sent into solitary confinement for making a forbidden speech. He was released back to his group some days later, only to discover that his comrades had beaten the informer so badly that he could not walk, see, or hear, because it was he who had reported Ed's speech to the wardens. When he was released from the prison hospital, the informer was given a cell of his own, and later was secretly moved out of the prison. Ed and his comrades supposed that the informer had been released from prison as he was of no further use to the prison authorities. Later, in 1951, this man was tracked down and liquidated by the underground National Socialist Revenge Squads. The authorities of Zutphen Prison tried various methods of influencing and politically re-educating the hardcore National Socialist prisoners on the P-Wing. In addition to the regular doses of hard labour and enforced boredom, there were compulsory religious services, along the lines of those tried by the authorities in Voigt concentration camp, where Ed had been incarcerated before his transfer to Zutphen. if the religious lecturings were insufficient, the prison authorities also flooded the P-Wing with large quantities of anti-Nazi literature. At first, much of this material was reprints of wartime propaganda, but later it was replaced by war crime and Nazi atrocity literature, the accusation being that those on the P-Wing had been responsible for those crimes. The SS men, who were prisoners on the wing, studied the war crime leaflets and booklets very closely. Often dates, places and units were mentioned, and often one of Ed's comrades on the P-Wing had been there or witnessed the events described. Those who could claim first-hand knowledge of the alleged atrocities would frequently point out the inaccuracy or fabrications of the information before them. As Ed later recalled, the literature was discussed with much hilarity in the hearing of the ever-present jailer, and we came to the conclusion that it was only lies, conquerors, propaganda, and a kind of dirty tricks indoctrination. As there were not only wardens listening to the prisoners discussing the atrocity literature, but informers among the religious prisoners too, and at first a mole among the men in Ed's group, feeding details back to the director's office. After quite a long period of time, the prison authorities decided to withdraw the war crimes material, as it was having no effect on either the National Socialist prisoners' morale or their ideology. It was around this time that a new assistant director was appointed to Zutphen prison. Unlike the dictatorial prison director Wetzinger, who was a Dutch Calvinist with rigid traditional ideas, the new man was a young Roman Catholic, schooled in the latest theories, a complete counterpart to his superior. One morning, the new assistant director came to the P-Wing, where he spoke very seriously to ex-comrade Fred. It seemed that the citizens of Zutphen had discovered that a supporting sand wall along the main railway line into the town was full of landmines. The dangerous situation had been discovered when a child, playing along the trackside, had been blown to pieces the day before, and so the prison authorities had been requested to provide mine clearance teams. It was the assistant director's task to select a squad from among the SS prisoners. As Fred was the senior SS prisoner on the P-Wing, the assistant director had decided to consult him as to who should make up the clearance squads. Unfortunately, Fred, as a regular infantry officer, had only superficial knowledge of mine laying and mine clearing, as the infantry usually relied on the pioneer troops to deal with such things. So Fred asked Ed if he had a working knowledge of mines and how to deal with them, as Ed's rearguard actions with the Oranienburg SS commando had involved mining roads and bridges. He had the necessary experience, and Ed requested the assistant director to assign two other Waffen-SS men from one of the other rooms on the P-Wing, who Ed knew were familiar with laying and handling mines. The assistant director was anxious to cooperate with putting together an efficient and experienced squad, and did not want to put the men's lives at risk. It was at this point that Ed remembered that one of the wardens on the outside working details had boasted of belonging to the resistance movement in wartime Zutphen. The assistant director sent for the warden and quizzed him about his part in the resistance, and was told that during the war, nothing of a military nature could happen in Zutphen without his finding out about it. Fred asked the warden if he knew who had mined the railway embankments around Zutphen, whether it had been the Germans or the Dutch resistance forces. After a long pause, the warden said that he did not know, but could only guess that it was the Germans. During the war, the lines into Zutphen were regularly used by open freight trains loaded with coal. The trains were often stationed on the sidings outside Zutphen overnight, and were guarded by a small detachment of elderly or semi-invalid soldiers. The Dutch civilians, being cold in winter and fuel being rationed, tried every night to steal as much coal as they could carry away, and frequently succeeded. It was entirely possible that the German railway police had laid mines to protect the freight trains. The warden stated that he had never heard of any mines exploding along the railway tracks, but would be very glad to lead the squad of SS men to search the area where the child was killed. The mine-clearing squad was assembled, and at Ett's request was equipped with small bladed spades. He also advised the warden to equip himself with a good rifle, in addition to his regulation pistol. The assistant director had wanted to accompany the mine clearers, but this was forbidden by his superior. The squad were loaded onto a truck, and within half an hour were unloaded at the site of the explosion. The small mine squad, consisting of Ett Volsink and two other SS men, began to carefully search the railway embankment for any telltale signs of buried booby traps. Slowly and deliberately, the trio started to dig into the soft earth, gently lifting spadefuls of soil and throwing it far behind them. In a short time, they had excavated two man-sized holes, but no mines. Ett reasoned that they could take their time to search along the rail track. After all, the assistant director himself had provided the squad with enough tobacco to last a week and a rather luxurious packed lunch. Certainly luxurious by prison food standards, anyway. After 2 hours' work with no results, Ett was beginning to give up the idea that a deliberately constructed minefield lay along the railway embankment, when suddenly one of the diggers called out, "A mine!" Walking softly across the loose soil, Ett and the other digger joined their comrade. There in the soil was a shining metal object. After a swift examination, Ett and the two others agreed that this was not a German mine, nor was it an American or British one. The Dutch resistance had used large quantities of air-dropped American or British military explosives and munitions, and Ett's training in both the Brandenburg and the Oranienburg had familiarized him with enemy munitions and weapons. The trio freed the object with their bare hands, as far as they dared, then dug a shallow trench back from the object to one of the other holes. The rest of the squad took cover as Ett approached their guard. Ett asked the warden, "Are you a good gunner?" Looking across at the mine rather sheepishly, the warden relied that he was not a sharp shooter, and was obviously nervous of a possible explosion. Frustrated by the nervous warden, Ett boldly stated, "Then give me the rifle. Is it any good?" The warden replied that he used it every week at his shooting club, and it was an accurate and reliable weapon. He handed it to Ett, who examined the weapon closely. It was an old-fashioned bolt-action service rifle of the pre-war Dutch army, not the most efficient firearm, but it was in good working order. "Give it to me," one of the other SS men said. "I used to be a prominent sharp shooter." Ett handed his comrade the rifle, and as the shooter took up his position, he and the others took cover. Ett lay down next to the warden, who was sweating with fear and trembling. Ett grinned at the former resistance hero and told him not to worry. "This is part of our daily fun, and nobody will hear a word about you rearming the Waffen-SS." One shot was fired, but nothing happened. Slowly, Ett and the others emerged from cover and approached the mystery object with great care. The bullet had passed through the object, leaving a shining, ragged hole. Calling upon the gods to protect him, one of the SS men reached forward and lifted out the mystery device. It proved to be the bottom half of an empty silver polish tin. After the laughter had subsided, the squad began to reconsider their mission. Ett argued that, whatever else, a child had been killed there a day ago. A crater and bloodstains proved that. So something dangerous had to be present along the railway track. The squad no longer believed that there was a minefield along the embankment, and anyway, they would need half a battalion to properly dig out the whole of the earth wall. The conclusion was that the child had found an unexploded projectile from a wartime Allied fighter bomber which had detonated when the unfortunate youngster had picked it up. A search of the area provided enough fragments to prove that the explosion had been from a small aerial bomb of the type used by Allied aircraft. The squad packed up all the bits into the warden's bag and gave him back his rifle, which he had completely forgotten about. The guard was still trembling and obviously needed a stiff drink, so they boarded the truck and returned to the prison. The assistant director was anxiously waiting for them on their return and immediately sought out the warden for his report. Still shaking from the experience, the guard could only stammer out a few words, which made little sense. So Ed's comrade Fred told the story, carefully omitting any compromising details. He advised the assistant director that extensive digging by experienced military mine-clearing squads was required if the railway embankments were to be declared safe. The assistant director expressed his thanks and returned to his office to pass on the report to the authorities in Zutphen. The warden departed to the pub for his much-needed drink, and Ed, Fred and Hans followed the assistant director to his office. The prison official made several telephone calls as Ed and his comrades stood along one wall of the office, listening to the conversations with interest. The young assistant director seemed to ignore the presence of the three prisoners, as he seemed to conspire against the senior director of the prison in his wording of his reports in favour of himself. The assistant director made no secret of his distaste for his superior and the dictatorial methods of him, and seemed determined to undermine the older man's position. The assistant director seemed to have softened towards Ed and his comrades as a result of their hard work and courage in the mine-clearing squad, and surprisingly suggested that they start a prison magazine. Not only that, he was prepared to put at their disposal a room with a typewriter, a stencil machine, and assorted stationery and paper. On top of this unprecedented supply of materials, the officer was also prepared to allocate 3 hours every day, except Sunday, for them to work on the magazine. The SS men could hardly believe their luck. Normally, after the main meal, all doors of the P-Wing were locked. The chance they were now offered meant that by rotation, all the ex-soldiers could be assembled every night, which would favour the continuation of National Socialist activities. The prisoners began planning straight away. By chance, the head inmate of room number 3 on the P-Wing, known to the rest as John the Stupid, was always boasting of his skills as a writer and printer. If his boasting was true, then with the help of just a few of the more educated prisoners from the criminal wing, they could proceed with the publication. This part of the plan did not sit well with the assistant director, who was wary of criminals mixing with the politicals. However, with a little gentle persuasion, he agreed to allow one or two individual criminals to join in the magazine work. The SS men did not want any of the religious objectors to be involved, both for ideological reasons and also because they regarded them as educationally substandard, incapable of even speaking decent Dutch. The assistant director was keen to make his mark as a progressive thinker, reforming the prisoners by offering educational and recreational opportunities. He promised to arrange everything for the magazine. Not only that, he offered to arrange external educational classes for those interested in improving their education. Ed was keen to exploit this situation and chose a course in commercial practice. Although he had left school with a good high school certificate, the opportunity to attend outside classes meant that he might possibly be able to contact his werewolf colleagues. No matter how slim the chances, he had to make the effort. Plus, it was a good chance to mix in class with free people. However, the assistant director wanted something in return. As a sign of goodwill, he asked for the SS prisoners' collaboration in the forthcoming Christmas celebrations. He knew full well that the die-hard National Socialists were anti-religion, especially since the bungled attempts of the previous pastors and priests at the prison. The prison authorities were short of decent organisers in other departments, and if they helped him, it would reflect well on his new methods. The SS men held back, their instinctive response to being involved in something they regarded with disdain. Instead, Fred promised on their behalf that he had some experience in such events and would provide an unforgettable ceremonial, especially as he had heard that a choir of girls from the Salvation Army would be present. As the assistant director was now feeling very pleased with himself and appeared to be in a generous mood, Ett spoke up about the standards of hygiene on the P-Wing. The general rule for the political prisoners was that when they returned from the days outside hard labour, they had a washdown, but due to strict Calvinist rules, were not allowed to strip naked and had to keep on their underpants in order to preserve modesty and the Christian sense of shame. To make matters worse, these ablutions had to be performed in a narrow washroom containing just a simple row of cold water taps. Needless to say, the prisoners could not wash properly in these conditions, and the only means of getting the soil and sand from between their legs was to go one at a time into the toilets with wet towels to sponge away the dirt in enforced privacy. The only relief from this ridiculous situation was the fortnightly shower, when 10 prisoners at a time were hustled into the shower block where they could enjoy 5 minutes under the spray of lukewarm water. The prison director himself had set the rules about washing and showers on both religious grounds and economic grounds. He argued that hot water cost money to heat, so the P-Wing prisoners got very little of it. After Ett had delivered his protest to the assistant director about the less than satisfactory hygiene facilities, there were some improvements. The P-Wing prisoners were granted showers 3 times a week instead of once every 2. But the prison director refused to budge on his Calvinist modesty rules in the washrooms. Nakedness was still banned. As a result of cooperating with the assistant director, life became more acceptable to the men on the P-Wing. Now there were nightly gatherings of all the NS prisoners, some 36 in all. Several times during these gatherings, Ett dropped the werewolf code word into the conversations, but only one of his fellow inmates reacted. This officer was an Obersturmführer from the SS regiment Westland. He and Ett spoke together privately and discovered that they both had the same orders for after the capitulation and could therefore easily work together. They realized that the two of them could not work miracles from the confines of Zutphen prison, but it gave Ett a good feeling to have a close ally on hand. From that point on, the study and recreation room became a centre of National Socialist conspiracy, SS ideology, and anti-clergy activity. Those few criminals who had been allowed to join the politicals in order to work on the magazine could not believe the conversations they overheard. However, these men held their tongues about the nightly gatherings, partly because they were afraid of the consequences, and partly because they felt a certain pride in the company of these dangerous and highly organized P-Wing prisoners. The truth was that the SS men had no intentions of returning to civilian life in some distant future as good democratic citizens. Their program was to retain their National Socialist ideology and to return to the civilian world as the heirs to Adolf Hitler, determined to continue the struggle. The NS prisoners kept their word to the assistant director, and Fred arranged the Christmas celebrations, an event which far outstripped and overshadowed the compulsory Sunday church services of the Protestant pastor and the Catholic priest. But for Ett, the one disturbing feature of the Christmas festival above all else was not the faked Christian piety, but the choir of the Salvation Army. It was not the songs, nor the sentiments of their music, but the sight and sound of the girls. The close proximity of young females caused great feelings of unrest in both Ett's body and those of his comrades. They all desperately needed female company, and the presence of the girls' choir only served to remind them that there was a world outside which they were all missing. The prison magazine, when it appeared, was quite a success, and went on to be printed and distributed as a regular publication. The prison director sent out copies to everyone of importance in the Dutch prison administration and justice system. The good reception it received, and the following subscriptions and circulation figures he automatically claimed the credit for, as well as pocketing any small profits. Later, the prison director was to use his successes at Zutphen as a stepping stone to the best paid position in the Dutch penal system, head director of Leeuwarden Maximum Security Prison. Et and his comrades on the P-Wing were resentful and constantly planning revenge on the ruling system, either in bloody conflict or economic sabotage. Here, they were able to use their time at Zutphen to learn from the professional criminals and gain an unorthodox education and a wealth of information. Much of what he learned at Zutphen proved useful to Ed in his life after prison, especially in the hotel trade. However, what Ed did not know was that in the early months of the following year, his life would change course dramatically and his time at Zutphen would be over. It was much later, around Christmas 1948, that Et was ordered to report to the visitors' room at Zutphen, where two strangers were waiting for him. The two men welcomed him and introduced themselves as members of Dutch Military Intelligence, MID, and they had an interesting offer for Et. The proposal was that he would be freed on a short term if he was prepared to work for them in an organization comparable to the Brandenburg. He would be operating against the Soviet Union as part of the Cold War. He would have the same rank as he had held at the capitulation. It was explained to Et that the complete series of Berlin papers had arrived at NATO headquarters and that after careful scrutiny, the Dutch intelligence services had linked Et Volsink to his cover name, under which he had operated during the war. Et had used his second family name on all official papers during his military service. The intelligence officers told Et that based on the new information, he was facing a new trial as a war criminal, unless, of course, he cooperated. Ever the survivor, Et told the intelligence officers that he himself had no aversion to their offer, but he needed the consent of his last responsible commander, SS General Josef Sepp Dietrich, who was imprisoned in Germany. The meeting was concluded, and the military intelligence officers left. To Et's amazement, events moved with unbelievable speed. He was transported by Dutch military intelligence to West Germany and admitted to the prison so he could speak with Dietrich. Although SS General Dietrich had nominally been Et's last commander, neither had met before, and Et Volsink first had to explain who he was and what his mission had been before enlightening Dietrich as to the offer from NATO. It is surprising to note that these discussions were held without guards or Dutch intelligence officers being present. Sepp Dietrich listened carefully to Et's story and gladly gave his blessing to the undertaking, but not before he had given Et a head full of instructions about how to combine his new duties with his existing role of werewolf operative. Dietrich made it clear that Et's werewolf orders still stood. He must follow his new function for NATO, but also must continue to fight for the restoration of National Socialism. Et returned to Zutphen prison, fully authorized at the highest level by both the werewolf and NATO. Then, for the third time in his life, Et Volsink received forged papers. From now on, he had real papers in his own name for civilian use and military papers under his old Brandenburg name for NATO use. It was as a relatively free man that Et entered life in a hostile post-war world, a world he regarded as corrupt, decadent, and democratic, ruled by an invisible Zionist dictatorship. The Dutch Military Intelligence Service had restored his last military rank in the Brandenburg, captain, and 2 weeks after his release from Zutphen, he was back in action, transported via French occupation forces into Austria and infiltrated into communist Hungary. Et soon realized that he was not alone as a former National Socialist officer fighting against communism in the new Cold War. And we'll hear more about Et's release from prison and what he got up to in the final episode tomorrow.
It's Radio Aryan at Radio Aryan.com.